Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me not only is Armin Navabi, who's regularly with me. Hey, Armin, how are you?
Hi.
But also, Susanna, and I'm just going to use her first name, right? That's the thing? First name? Okay, there we go. First name. So Susanna is the CEO of Atheist Republic, right? Mm-hmm. Newly minted. And she's doing a phenomenal job. And she's here because this topic is actually something that is very close to her heart and her life. So welcome, Susanna, for the first time. Really excited to have you here. Talk
well,
a lot
the
offline.
First time.
Yeah.
The first time I ever talked to you guys was on this show. And then within the span of 3 weeks, like 2 or 3 months, Armin handed over the keys to his entire organization to me. But it's crazy that that's how it started.
You were one of the best guests that we've had here, and it was one of the most popular episodes. People absolutely loved you. So, and now the guest that we have today, okay, this is a topic I'm surprised we haven't talked about more in the past, and I'd like to start talking about more. We're going to talk about sex and God. Right, and we have us Dr. Daryl Ray. Dr. Daryl Ray is an organizational psychologist, and he is the author of the book Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality, which I pretty much read almost all of in in a day, because it's just a phenomenal book. He's also the author of other books like The God Virus. He's also the founder and president of the board of directors of Recovering from Religion. And we are just thrilled to have you here today, Dr. Ray. Thank you for joining.
I'm delighted to be here. First time I've ever been on your show, and I don't know how that's ever happened, but I'm glad to be here now.
Yeah, sorry about that. We should have done this a long time ago.
Not a problem.
We might catch up by having you on more and more.
So. Okay, great. I'd love it. Armin and I have known each other for years. I don't know. We go back a ways.
Yeah, I keep every time we ever mention sex and God or religion and God, I brag about meeting you and I show people your book and I also show you signing it. So I know that people who are not patrons can see this right now because we're like, but yeah, this is the book. I was at your place. I read your book. I love it. And every time I talk about sex and God, I mention people that this is a book that they need to read.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I hope I don't owe you any royalties or anything for that, do I?
No, I mean, this is all I needed.
Okay.
So I want to start just by asking you a question. This is something that I've thought about a lot and I wrote about in my book as well. And that is, so just starting with this glamorization of virginity in religion, starting with Mary. Okay, so Mary, the mother of Jesus. Now, this is something in Christianity, it's in Islam too. She was pure and chaste, innocent, because she had never had sex and she was a virgin. And Jesus was born in a very one-way, her vagina was a one-way canal, essentially, birth canal, because God forbid any man ever touch her. And this is kind of, this to me seems like it's related to everything from slut shaming, victim blaming, honor culture. I wouldn't say it's the only root of it, but it's such a huge part of just most of the people who follow Christians and Muslims, the two largest Abrahamic religions in the world. So just to start with the taboos, the glamorization of identity and taboos around sexuality, why is religion so obsessed with them?
It goes deeply into the simple notion that if you can control somebody's sexual drive, sexual nature, then you can control them. And this was something that the patriarchal religions discovered fairly early. You'll notice it does not appear in the non-patriarchal religions. You don't see it in Wicca or paganism. Actually, you don't even see it in a lot of so-called tribal religions. I mean, they can be patriarchal. But the fact is, early on, patriarchal religions learned you have to control your women. And the reason you have to control your women is because you need to know who your children are. And then if you know where your children are, you can pass your, not your genes, because they didn't know anything about that. You pass your property on to them. So it's really important to control sexuality. And that was the basis for patriarchal religions like Zoroastrianism, like Judaism. Christianity comes along and it's just another iteration, if you will, of this. And what it comes along and says, maybe we can totally control. I mean, think about this, Ali. In the Catholic tradition, the best person in Catholicism is the celibate person, the person who never has sex in their entire life. Now, if you were to ask me what's the most perverted sexual thing you can think of, my answer to that question would be a Catholic priest. That is the most perverted thing. Now, if you can control somebody so much that they don't even want to sexually reproduce, that's some pretty powerful control.
Yeah.
Now, go back. Something.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and then that ties to the Mary thing, because sexuality itself is defined as wrong, as evil, as a part of the fall with Adam and Eve. So you have to have the Virgin Mary. She has to be pure and non-sexual. You cannot have, I write about this in Sex and God. I say the Virgin Mary has to be a virgin in order for this whole sex narrative and sexual control narrative, because she cannot pass on the sins of Adam and Eve. Her being a virgin means she was impregnated by God. So the sins of Adam and Eve are not coming through her. So that means Jesus is pure. Now, of course, all this narrative comes 200 years, at least 100 years after this whole so-called Jesus. I don't believe the guy existed to begin with. But even if he did, it comes 100 to 120 years after. So this the fine-tuning of this Mary narrative didn't come out of the year one. It came out of the year 90.
You asked in your book, if one thing it said, did Jesus masturbate?
Yep.
Which is a great question, because I mean, he was celibate. He wasn't married. He didn't reproduce. Nobody can think that. I mean, nobody really thinks of him as having sex. So right. What did he do to get, like, did he ever get off? What did he do to get, did he like to be something? And I think,
if you go Google, did Jesus masturbate, you'll see my talk. I give a whole talk on did Jesus masturbate. It's been quite a popular talk over the years. And there's four possible answers. I'm not going to give away the answer, but I know
made
the
that
answer.
The title of this, yeah. Of this show, did Jesus masturbate? Maybe we'll have another episode.
Go find the people if you want to see the four answers. Go find the video. I did want to see, like, the way I don't know if you agree with this or not, but the way I look at it is, if the reason why sexuality needs to be is controlled by religion, and even not just religion, other authoritarian dogmatic worldviews as well, is by controlling women, by controlling access to women, removing, taking away the freedom for women themselves to decide who has access to them sexually, by giving that control to men over who has access sexually to women, you can control men. So this is about men controlling other men by having the say on who has access to women. Because this is one of the most powerful ways to motivate men to follow your commands, because you get to say who gets to be with what woman. What do you think? Is that a...
Well, actually, you're right down the alley of a great book that was written just a couple of years ago by Dr. Hector Garcia called Alpha God. You should talk to Dr. Garcia, by the way. He should be on your list of people to talk to. And he will explain it almost exactly like you just did. And the simple fact is, from his perspective, I don't write about it in that perspective in my own book, though I don't disagree at all. I agree very much with him. And that is, we're all primates, and we tend to act like primates. Well, if you look at all the primates, from gorillas to chimpanzees to bonobos, you can see, or even orangutans and other non-great apes, you can see primate behavior looks a whole lot like us. And the control of women, the control of females, the control of mates is really important in the gorilla and the chimpanzee world, not nearly as important in the bonobo world. So we're just following the line of primates. Controlling access to mates and controlling mates is a big part of the way the chimpanzees work, big part of the way the gorilla community works too.
Is there a power thing? And so this may be politically incorrect, but is it fair to say that with men, right, a lot of their power is, you talk about physical strength, you know, labor, they could lift weight, they could fight each other, they can beat each other up. But with women, sexual power is a big thing. It's brought down emperors. It's actually brought down a lot of men. It can destroy men. It can destroy empires and nations. The power of female sexuality. So could it be something more direct that you want to, like, female sexuality is so powerful and it's so threatening to men, and it can sway them into the path of self destruction in general. I mean, people use this all the time. You've got everything from honey traps. I mean, there's presidents, leaders, everything can be destroyed with it. So to demonize it and to say that this is any woman who uses it for her advantage or to get ahead or anything is, you know, a harlot or, you know, like whatever terms they used to use, or a witch. And to even make women think that that's something to be terribly ashamed of. Whereas if a man uses his physical strength to go and build buildings and his blood, sweat, and tears and the integrity of hard work. I mean, it's just, I wonder if there's anything to that.
Yes, there is I won't say there's not. I would just look at the history. There's two things. First, that supports your hypothesis. First of all, the very first story in all of the Bible, the Old Testament Bible and the Torah is a story of sexual shame. You know, Adam and Eve recognized that they were naked. And, you know, that's the very first story in the whole damn Bible is about sexual shame. And it goes downhill from there. So the notion that shame is an important part, and it was, of course, the woman that caused the shame. She was the one that broke the so-called commandment not to eat the fruit and that sort of stuff. But I think more importantly, let's get away from Bibles and all that sort of bullshit. Let's get into the history and look at the history of cultures and where you see significant new levels of control of mates and females is when you have agriculture. Until agriculture and a hunter-gatherer society, the female is supplying 60 to 70% of all the calories for the family. The male is only supplying 20 to 30, 40% at most of the calories for the family. So the most important source of food is through the female. And you're a hunter-gatherer society. You may or may not have rules around sexuality, but we have a lot of evidence that shows women had a lot more fluidity in hunter-gatherer societies. Look at the Hadza right now. A woman will let a man move in with her, and I mean let a man move in with her for 4 or 5 years. They may have a kid together. When she's tired of him, she kicks him out, and another man will move in. A woman might go through a half a dozen so-called marriages among the Hadza in her lifetime. If you look at the Mooso, and that's why I talk about this in Sex and God, I talk about all the other cultures. And the reason I'm going in this direction, Ali, is because we get blinded by Western and patriarchal religions and their notions about control and sexuality. And we think there's something normal about monogamy. Well, there's nothing normal about monogamy. Even Islam is not a monogamous religion. But even if you weren't an openly monogamous religion, most primitive religions, and I use that term, I shouldn't even use that term, primitive, pre-Western, pre-contact religions, had very different sexualities, sexualities you would never recognize. For example, South America, there's 46 tribes in the Amazon. 28 of them, or something plus or minus a few, have got a concept called partible paternity. Have you ever heard of that concept, Ali? Most people haven't.
No.
Now think about this. Half or more of the cultures in Amazon believe in partible paternity. This is important because we think there was a lot of cultures before patriarchy, before West, before religion came along that believed in partible paternity. Here's what partible paternity is. It's the belief that a woman cannot have healthy babies unless she has sex with multiple men.
Yeah.
And if you're a primitive scientist in the Amazon and you watch a peccary, and you'll notice that a female peccary mates with two or three other males, and you watch a dog and you'll notice that a female dog mates with two or three males before she has a litter, that might lead you to believe it takes multiple males to make healthy babies. Now, a woman who only has sex with one man and has an unhealthy baby that dies, it only has to happen once or twice, and people start saying, well, you need to have more sex with more men.
Yeah, I read about this in Sex at Dawn. It's
the
book Sex at Dawn, where they actually talked about how there are chemicals in human semen that actually kill the sperm of other men. So it's meant to be that way. The reason that the female orgasm takes a lot longer is so that more men can mate with her and it selects for the best genes. But anyway.
But just to be clear, we're not talking about anything that is true. We're just talking about what people believed back then, and how different it is from what we consider.
Yeah, right. But let's not say back then, because these tribes believe it to this day. As we speak, there are 26 tribes that believe this about biology. So no, it's a belief structure, just like we've got a belief structure in North America. You know, some places have a belief that you can't have sex before marriage or it'll ruin your marriage. That's a belief. It has nothing to do with biology.
Right. And we're not endorsing it. I think what we're saying is that none of this matters. You get to have fun. It's not even about like what is the best way to have a baby. Sex is about having fun. Like sex should be about enjoyment rather than what's the most ideal way to have to structure a family or anything like that. Right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. We were talking earlier. I know Susanna was mentioning religious trauma and her own journey around sexuality. And if we did not have these crazy ideas in our culture and in our families about sex, you wouldn't have this drama. You wouldn't have this trauma or drama around your body, about how you look, what you want to do, how you enjoy yourself. For example, masturbation. It's the most simple, most basic form of sexual expression. And it's the first form. And oh, by the way, your body is your first sex partner. So we teach people that that's wrong and that's bad in many cultures. And yet people, as a psychologist, as a clinician working with people in my office, and I have somebody come in and says, I can't orgasm, especially women, I'll ask them, can you orgasm yourself by masturbating? And they get the horrified look on their face. Oh no, I could never do that. Well, why? Because it's wrong. Or my Catholic grandmother told me not to, or, you know, whatever. You got this message from the priest or the minister. So if you can't orgasm yourself, how are you going to teach your partner how to orgasm, help you orgasm? So it's really critical that we get rid of these myths. And what I try to do in the Sex and God book is just show you all the other belief structures around sexuality. Because in the West, we tend to think that that's normal sexuality. And I'm here to tell you, Western sexuality and Muslim sexuality and Hindu sexuality are perverted. They are not normal. They're anything but normal. Mm-hmm. Now, don't... don't ask me what normal is, because that's a big question.
Actually, before we get into why Hindu and Christian and Islamic sexuality, there, what's wrong with them, you mentioned Susanna talking about this before we went live. Should we get, like, do we want to bring Susanna into discussion?
Absolutely. I'm waiting for her to jump in here.
Yeah.
I texted you, Susanna. I was like, you got to jump in, because if it's me and Armin here, there's no way, unless you have to force yourself in here.
So maybe the best way to the best way to do this is to get that conversation that we had earlier going. Maybe Susanna, do you want to tell people how did religion influence shame and guilt with you, and then we could get Dr. Daryl Ray to analyze what went wrong, what happened here. How about that? Let's go.
Okay. I'm just like sitting quietly in the corner, like it's still like something I have difficulty talking about. It's very easy for me to have a Catholic shame spiral, as I call it. So part of me is like, why did I sign up for this? Oh my god, I don't even know where to begin. Based on how people talk about me growing up as a child, like, I remember reading a note from my daycare person who gave a letter to my mom that she'd write at the end of every year, I'm taking care of this. So this is me at the age of 4. What I remember from this note, because my mom, you know, keeps all this stuff, is like, Susanna always enjoyed dressing down more than dressing up. Like the other girls. And so obviously in a Catholic family, like, that's not okay. In fact, I think it's the way I internalized it is that that's actually dangerous. Maybe in a attempt to actually protect me, you know, me trying to be empathetic and give the benefit of the doubt to my parents. There's so much messaging I got around sex and sexuality, primarily that it is dangerous, that it will hurt you, that I was never really allowed a lot of information around it. And so me being a young person in this day and age, my response was to go seek that information out myself, right?
Right.
Because it's all
which
around
any healthy, intelligent person would do.
Yeah, yes. Because it's, you know, in the culture all around me. It's also not even just the culture, it's a fact of life. I'm curious. I'm a young woman. I want to understand. But it was always communicated like, this is bad, don't do it, but never explained why.
Right.
And so a lot of other things about the general influence of Catholicism, this like, I almost feel like there's something specifically so Catholic about this culture of silence, just like silence around certain topics. That it just became ingrained in my personality to seek out the taboo, because no one is explaining to me why this is forbidden. It's just forbidden. Don't do it. Don't touch it. Don't look. And when we catch you seeking out information, when we catch you being curious, you're going to be punished for it.
Right. Right.
So there is nothing in my life that I was faced as many consequences for in my family unit than sex and sexuality.
Right.
Did you experience any internal, because as I personally, when it comes to Islam, I experienced a lot of not just outside pressure from family and community, but also internal guilt and shame with my own thoughts. Did you experience any of that as well?
You know the answer to this, sir. The answer is yes to this day. So, I've gotten a lot better, like literally within this year is the first year that things have like started to turn around for me. But when you're told that it's bad, it's dirty, and then specifically the things that you happen to be curious about are particularly bad, dangerous, worthy of disgust, condemnation, utter disdain, I literally last year, last October, I remember having a breakdown, sobbing over how broken I felt, that it wasn't fair that other people my age, I was only 23 at the time, could go and just have sex and enjoy themselves and explore themselves and other people and just be carefree, and I couldn't. Because I knew that if I did that, it would be, it just because of all the indoctrination, just like shatter my sense of self.
Right.
The depths of it just triggers my self-loathing deeply. And because it triggers my self-loathing so deeply, or did, you know, I'm better now. I couldn't even approach it, and I felt so broken over the shame.
What you've described is something I think is important to realize, is that religions like Catholicism, but also Islam, a Baptist, they all create a terror of sex and sexuality, mm-hmm. and a loathing of our own bodies, mm-hmm. which means that we skip developmental stages that are really important for humans. So you oftentimes skip in the prepubescence or adolescence entire stages where you feel shamed even being attracted to another person, mm-hmm. or you feel great guilt about touching your genitals and masturbating. Those stages are important as humans. And we know in other animals, if you force an animal to skip a developmental stage, in their later stages, they will not act appropriately for mm-hmm. their species. In fact, they won't act appropriately in this way. If you take any rat or a possum or any kind of mammal and you screw up its adolescence, so to speak, when it gets to be of mating age, it may not know how to mate. It will literally never learn the ability to mate. Well, we see a lot of that in our society, where people lose the ability to mate with other people or match up with other people because they never had a good adolescence. They don't know how, a boy does not know how to talk to a girl respectfully because he's never seen that modeled anywhere. And a girl doesn't know how to actively seek out a boy that she's attracted to without feeling guilty, or to even touch her own body without feeling guilty. And that's what I hear you describing, Susanna. You were describing someone who missed a developmental phase of your life.
Wait, so does that mean that they're damaged beyond repair now?
No, not at all. No, okay. But it just means she's got a hard job ahead of her, and she's telling us right now that she's working. She doesn't sound like she's doing a good job. But think about this. What if she'd never been exposed to that bullshit and was allowed to go through a sex-positive adolescent? What would she be talking about with us today?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
No, I gasped when you said that, because that's literally what my therapist was saying to me recently. She was like, the word she used was stunted. And right. It really hit me. I was like, oh my God, you're so right. She's like, this is a part of you that was stunted from like the age of 8 or 9.
Yes.
And right. It's to the point that she literally, I mean, again, just over the past couple of months, I've improved so much. I'm really proud of myself. Like it's incredible that I can even talk about it like publicly, seriously. She literally mandated that I go on dates. She like made it my homework.
Good for her.
She's like, Susanna, you're never going to grow past this if you don't go practice. and like allow yourself to practice, especially coming from a very Abrahamic background. Like, it's this idea that I had ingrained, this understanding that if I date anyone, I'm already just on dating, entering that, believing that I have to be prepared to marry this person.
Yeah,
that's insane.
It is insane. You're right. If you go back, I mean, if you do a little mental exercise, Susanna, or anyone, it's not just Susanna, go back and look at what were kids, let's say a kid that you know grew through a family that was sex positive. Maybe they were a kid that grew up in a family that was two gay parents, you know, but they're very sex positive, or they're straight parents, but they're sex positive. What was that child doing at 13, 14, 15, 16? What were the lessons they were getting? What was the behavior they were allowed to do? What skills were they being taught? And those are the skills you did not get taught. But what were you being taught? You were being taught the opposite of that, the negative of that, that your body is your enemy, that looking at other people is sinful, that you can't touch your own body, that you can't go on dates because that means you're going to marry him. I mean, all these, just, it's almost the mirror image of sex positivity. And
yeah, your mind and heart is going down the gutter.
Yeah, exactly. So Armin, in answer to your question, she is simply learning the skills, and her therapist has figured this out. She's simply learning the skills she missed when she was 14 years of age.
So what purposes does the, because a lot of people look at, a lot of atheists and anti-atheists look at religion as completely idiotic. And I mean, to be fair, they have a point, but
to be fair.
Yeah. But even though the beliefs themselves are idiotic, the system itself and how it survives is genius, right? Mm-hmm. Basically it's the survival of the means rather than survival of the genes, and the memes that have the best strategy to survive, and it's become the Darwinism of the memes, and they survive this. Islam and Christianity and Hinduism all of a sudden become very powerful memes. So the strategy, again, even though there's no designers or any conscious person designing these memes, on purpose, they end up becoming strategically very, very, great at coming up with ideas or values or scare tactics that works the best, right? So when we look at the shame and the guilt in religion, we can ask ourselves, like, what's the purpose of this? It must have, just like when we're looking at the feature in an animal when it comes to evolution and the survival of genes, we're like, this must have a reason why it's there, or else it wouldn't be there if it didn't help with the survival of this animal. When we look at religion, I think we could ask ourselves, this guilt and this shame, what was the purpose of this? How did it help in the survival of memes like Hinduism, Christianity, or Islam? So the shame and guilt that I experienced and Susanna experienced, what would be your answer? How do you think this helped these religions survive?
Well, I call it, in my book, The Godbearers, I write about the guilt cycle. This is related to something Ali was talking about before we came on air. And that is that the guilt cycle is what keeps you infected with the meme, with religion, the God virus, if you will. So you are taught, let's just take a simple example. You are taught that you shouldn't eat cookies before supper. And so, but you really are hungry, and there's cookies in that cookie jar. So you go and you get a cookie and you eat it, knowing you should not do that, but your mom catches you. And she slaps her hand, says, don't do that before supper. And you go and eat supper and you're okay. Next day, you're hungry again and that cookie sure tasted good and mom's not around. So you sneak the cookie and you eat it. Well, your response, your emotional response is that, oh, I broke mom's rule. Now we call that the beginnings of guilt. So now you've broken mom's rule. We've gone the cycle. You're starting to feel bad about breaking mom's rule. Mom may never catch you. But think about this. You might go through your entire life, the rest of your life, knowing and feeling guilty if you ate a cookie before supper. Mm-hmm. I know people who still do that. My mom taught me that, and I could eat a cookie anytime I damn well please, and yet I still feel guilty about eating a cookie before supper. Hey, we haven't even talked about religion. That's just a cookie. Now, Now your religion says touching your body and masturbating is a mortal sin and you will go to hell for it. Now, think about this. When you're 5 years old and your parents say, don't go out there and play in the woods because there's a lion that might eat you. If you're a smart kid, you will listen to your parents, or you'll get eaten by a lion and you won't pass your genes along or your memes along. But your same parent says, don't go over into that bush because there's demons over there. Your brain at 5 years old cannot determine the difference between getting potentially eaten by a lion or being sent to hell by a demon. It's indistinguishable. They're both equally important in the baby's brain. So your mom tells you masturbation is wrong. It will send you to hell. It'll kill you forever. You won't be around your mom and dad anymore, you know, all that sort of stuff. Your brain now realizes, oh, I touched myself. I masturbated. And now what am I going to do? Well, the religion says, but if you'd accidentally touch yourself, come to confession if you're a Catholic, read your Quran, pray 5 times, do all this other stuff, and you can get out of hell free card. It's a get out of hell free card, but you have to come back to religion to do it. So you can see the cycle goes back around. You're going to masturbate. You're going to have sex with your girlfriend. You're going to have dreams that you shouldn't have, and you can get out of it by coming back to church. So I call it the guilt cycle because it constantly reinforces the shame and guilt that religion taught you in the first place, just like the cookie.
Oh, sorry, so, Armin.
So this.
I wanted to kind of, Susanna, you're saying you're still having trouble breaking away from it. I just thought of something, and I'm going to actually share it, is that I'm in my 40s, and I've had a few divorces in my life. And a lot of that had to do with being raised with this idea that sex, and I was raised with this too, even though I came from a relatively open family, that sex is generally dirty outside of marriage, but sex is a beautiful thing when you're married. And the problem with that is that when you find somebody that is a sexual partner, like the first few sexual partners, then if the sex is good, you think, oh my God, I'm in love with this person, even though you have nothing in common with them. And then in my case, I ended up getting married, right? To these kinds of, this is like when I was very young, and this actually happened a couple of times, and it's very destructive. Like this idea that, you know, you should save sex for marriage and sex, it changes the trajectory of your life when you can't differentiate the two, and you think that good sex must absolutely be associated with you being in love with this person, and that's why this is a person you should be with. And a lot of times the people you have the best sex with are really the worst people to get into. Right? It's
whoa.
Yeah, that's something, I don't know. But anyway, I'm just sharing that because I think it was really, really courageous and really brave for Susanna to say what she did. And I was like, I just want to applaud that. But I wanted to ask you about, we've been talking about guilt and shame, right? Guilt and shame. But in your book, you make a distinction between guilt and shame, where guilt is more of a personal thing, like the cookie, you know, you're feeling it on your own, nobody's watching you. But then you have shame where there are other people involved and you are being sort of, there's an element of humiliation and so on. And you talk about Christianity being a sort of a guilt, sexual guilt religion, whereas Islam and Hinduism and some of these religions associated with honor cultures are shame religions. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
No, I think that's a really important distinction because it helps you see that each religion uses techniques for its particular propagation. Now, Christianity was, if you think about the way Christianity started, it was a lone religion competing against many other religions in the Mediterranean. And it was going up against pagan religions and, you know, Mithraism and Egyptian gods and stuff. So it was in a competitive environment that it had no political power. So it has to find a way to propagate itself. And it found through its roots in Judaism, because Judaism has a ton of religious sexual guilt in it, whereas Mithraism did not, and Asherism did not, and many of the Mediterranean religions we're actually more sex positive. They even had female goddesses and stuff like that. So I'm not saying they were sex positive. They were more sex positive than Judaism. Judaism at the time was one of the weirdest religions on the planet because it had so much sex negativity to it. But Judaism is a shame-based religion. Christianity is a guilt-based religion. And let me make the distinction, which will then help us understand why Islam and Hinduism are shame-based. A shame is related to your identity. And if your identity is bound up in a given community and the behavior that goes with that community, to violate that behavior not only makes you feel bad, but you don't want anybody else to know. And if they do know, they will shame you. They will then sanction you, socially sanction you. They'll cut you off, throw you out of the community, punish you, disavow you. And there's all sorts of negative social consequences that come with shame, because shame is your identity and you have violated your identity within this larger community. Guilt, on the other hand, is a rule that you've embedded in your brain, like the cookie example I gave you earlier, and it might not even be related to the community you're in. I can feel guilt about a behavior. I could go to India as a Christian. I could go to India as a Christian and be among Hindus and still feel guilty about masturbating. Whether they do or not, it's irrelevant. But in a Muslim culture, or in some aspects of Jewish culture, I wouldn't just feel shame about masturbation. I would feel I would feel shame if somebody found out I masturbated. So if I say I masturbate, and by the way, I do sometimes more than once a day.
It's a hobby.
It's a hobby. If I admit this to my community, they will shame me for that. And it's a community activity to control your behavior. It works really well in religions that have a lot of communal control. But remember, Christianity did not start that way. It started little pockets all over the place. And when Christianity got to some place like North America or Northern Europe, there were little pockets that were filled against other pockets that weren't Christian or were isolated. So it's harder to maintain a community shame-based system. So guilt became the control mechanism of preference. So basically, you carry the shame, the guilt police in your head, whereas in Saudi Arabia, they have the shame police literally walking the streets.
Right. So if I understand this, guilt is what you use when you have a lot of competition, and if you have a lot of competition and competing ideas that might steal people away from you, you need to internalize the enforcement rather than relying on external shame based from community. You need to get the informants from within rather than from outside. Exactly. Because the external world is competing for you, and that's why you need to build like the internal police rather than an external police. That's when you get guilt.
It's exactly right. Susanna, okay. What were you going to say there?
It's just interesting to me because I have like a journal basically that I wrote when I was 20 about a lot of the shame and just internal self-loathing around my sexuality. And I was studying psychology at the time, so I included bunches of texts actually from my textbooks that helped me understand kind of what I was going through. In a quote that I included from Raising a Moral Child by Adam Grant, this is from my developmental psychology course, was, "Shame is the feeling that I am a bad person, whereas guilt is the feeling that I have done a bad thing. Shame is a negative judgment about the core self, which is devastating. Shame makes children feel small and worthless, and they respond either by lashing out at the target or escaping the situation altogether. In contrast, guilt is a negative judgment about an action, which can be repaired by good behavior." Yeah. Which is so interesting to me. So I see how you mean the Christianity as a whole is guilt because there is salvation through Christ. But I was just sitting there thinking, because to me, based on everything I've studied about the distinction between the two, like what I experience is shame. Like it's about
yeah, right.
the core judgment of my character, myself.
Right.
maybe
I am
because of the communal aspect of how tight of a Catholic community I was in. I was in Catholic education almost my entire life.
Exactly.
But in terms of the theology, I think the assessment of guilt is correct because it can be repaired through salvation. Yeah.
Guilt is I did a bad thing. Shame is I am bad. That's a simple distinction from a psychological perspective. But remember, I'm talking more from a sociological perspective here. And I'll tell you, Catholicism uses shame just as much as it does guilt, probably. All religions use both shame and guilt. All I'm saying is that they tend to go to one or the other based upon their circumstances. In Saudi Arabia, shame is extremely effective. Who gives a damn if somebody feels guilty? Because if you violate something, you're going to get stoned to death or get your head chopped off. You don't need a lot of guilt. Now, that's not to say they don't have guilt, but in your family, you weren't going to get stoned to death and you weren't going to get your head chopped off. So you still need to inculcate enough guilt in there, because when you leave the house, there's no shame police out there. Ooh, there isn't.
That hits.
I did, before Ali moved away from masturbation, I wanted to talk about it a little bit more, but he moved away from there. I just want to go back a little bit.
Never move away from masturbation. I don't care what's going on. This is right. That's a false accusation, Norman.
False accusation. I do want to touch on it a little bit before we go to asking about Hinduism a little bit. So is it correct to say, this is my assumption, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, that, again, I know there are not people that decided this willingly, but it looks like that, so I'm just going to use the terminology as if they did. Is it fair to say that masturbation was put there as something sinful and vile and disgusting, specifically because young men are going to fail at not masturbating? Like that became a sin because you're going to fail at abiding by this rule. So it was there for failure. It was, they told you not to do it because they knew you're going to fail at this task, so that you feel disgusting, so you do feel shame and or guilt, and that you have to come back to the church or to the mosque or to the temple for purification, for forgiveness, and you're going to have to be convinced that this is why you need religion, because you suck so much at being good, and that's why you become relevant, the church becomes relevant, or the mosque becomes relevant in your life, right?
Yes, so if you look at it from this direction, I mean, we've got these no-fat movements all over the place, and some of them are even atheists, which I do not understand. Don't masturbate for whatever reason. Well, I'm going to tell you that, notice, there's no prohibition against women masturbating. I mean, they've now started saying that, but go back 20 years, nobody was talking about women shouldn't masturbate. They were just saying men should not masturbate. Even the Mormon church, that has an entire program based upon helping boys not masturbate, never thought about women or girls until just recently.
Maybe they didn't know a woman masturbates.
I was going to say the same thing. It's true. Like, there's a lot of, not only that, I think it's more known because men came up with all this stuff, so they knew what they're doing. And men, just everything's kind of out there, so it's kind of easy to figure out. It's not as easy for women to figure out all the time, but it was men who created this stuff. I don't think they knew.
Well, what Ali was, I mean, Armin was saying, I would generally agree. I think that it's a guaranteed failure. So if you can, remember, if I can teach you that your body's your enemy and then you fail at controlling your body, then you've got to come back to Jesus, a la Shiva. You got to come back to somebody to help you get out of the guilt.
Right.
And if it's a shame-based culture, you have to do public penitence in order to get away from the shame that the community is putting on you. And sometimes it's impossible. If a girl has sex in Iran, if a girl has sex before marriage, she is permanently marked for the rest of her life. That's how powerful shame is. Guilt doesn't do that to you, but shame does.
Does circumcision, and especially like male circumcision, and I know we know about female genital mutilation, and but specifically about this, because this is so much more accepted among the majority of Jewish people, even secular Jews and the majority of Muslim people. Was the inhibition of sexuality a driver in that, or was it just sort of loyalty to the sort of the local leaders? I mean, because you write about this a little bit in your book, and I know that they say that if you circumcise, then men are boys, little boys are less likely to masturbate, which is a hypothesis that I debunked quite copiously, like when I was growing up. But it's absolutely not true. But it's, well, it somehow prevents it. But
most cultures do not circumcise males or females, but there are a lot of cultures that have over the course of time in history and cultures. And there's different forms of circumcision. As we know, some are really bad. I mean, all are bad basically, but they vary quite a bit in the practice. The fact about circumcision, especially in North America, is that it wasn't practiced in North America until the 1920s. In Europe, circumcision is Kellogg. Kellogg, Dr. Kellogg of Kellogg cereal. And his myth, and he propagated this myth, was that boys who are circumcised won't masturbate as much, which is, again, and it was religious. The guy was religious as hell. He was married, but he probably never had sex. I mean, this guy was really screwed up in the head sexually. And he's telling everybody else to circumcise boys. It's a part of that narrative that comes out of the very first chapter of the Bible, that your body is your enemy and you have to control your body. And if you don't, you're a failure in the eyes of God. So it's got all that. It's got everything we need to create a guilt cycle, if you will. And masturbation. So what the religion is trying to do is trying to say your body's your enemy. So we're going to cut part of it off, so it won't be as much of your enemy. And that's kind of the attitude that some people that I think came out of it. But let's go back to Armin's point earlier. These are memes. These are evolving just like the coronavirus evolves. And why it began is really lost to history and lost to time. So, Ali, I have no idea how the first circumcision came about or why it was so successful, but I do know it propagates rather well today and has for centuries in some places like Israel and Judaism. And it is propagated for centuries in Islam, too. And female genital mutilation has propagated for centuries. I mean, it's a horrible practice, but I want to think about this. Will get back to Islam, because I want to target Islam briefly, if I may. I'm an expert on Christianity, but I'm also pretty knowledgeable about Islam. I think we mentioned trauma and religious trauma. We see religion creating trauma in children at very early ages. Now, if you take and tell a child your body's your enemy, you're dirty, you're filthy, and all that from a very early age, and they grow up believing that, oh, and then at about 12 years of age, you give them a party saying this is going to be a thing you're going to do for God, and you cut off their genitals and mutilate their genitals, male or female, at 12 years old with no anesthesia, do you think that might traumatize somebody? So here's my contention. Cultures that circumcise run the risk, if not the certainty, of traumatizing virtually every person in that culture. So if you look at circumcising cultures, I'm going to suggest that there is an inordinate amount of trauma in those cultures that's directly related to sex and directly related to circumcision.
They can't stop fighting each other in Israel, the Muslims and the Jews.
Exactly. So I think it's kind of a wild hypothesis on my part, and I'm not saying I've got scientific evidence for it, but I think I've got a lot of observations. I think people get traumatized fairly early in life by the treatment they're given by their parents, by their families, by their communities. And if that treatment includes being extremely sex negative and even genital mutilation for boys or girls, then you're just adding trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma. And those people are never going to get over that trauma in their lifetime. And they're going to propagate that to their children, and they're going to propagate it onto their communities, and they're going to have wars with other communities based upon that trauma. So that's kind of my pet theory about some of what's going on.
It's torture. You're torturing, your own infants.
Exactly. Exactly. And don't tell anybody an infant 8 days old getting circumcised isn't getting body memories. There's something going on there.
But even if they didn't remember, like, imagine if I went and, like, kidnapped an adult and tortured them with a knife and then wiped their memory and be like, hey, it's not a crime anymore because he doesn't remember. Well, I mean, you tortured somebody. That person went through hell through your. I mean, and that would be a huge crime. That would be headline news if I did this to an adult. But apparently, if you do it to a helpless infant that they cannot defend themselves, all of a sudden it becomes A-okay.
Right, in the name of God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You can't really erase that kind of memory just technically, because
even if you did, it would still be torture.
No, yeah, that's of course.
Yeah. Right. Right. Well, I don't know what our time frame is. When are we need to sign off?
Okay, I wanted to ask about Hinduism really quickly and how it became sex negative, and then also
you have about five more minutes. Yeah,
five more. And but we also had like questions in the live chat. Do we get like 5 minutes for that as well?
My bottom line is I want to tell people about recovering from religion.
Yeah, that was the last thing I was going to ask as well. Yeah. Okay.
So can I do that?
And yes, let's do that now. Let's do that now. Okay.
I just want your listeners to realize that there's people out there who care and want to help you. And all you have to do is go to recoveringfromreligion.org and hit the chat button or call. We have direct phone lines from the United Kingdom, from South Africa, from Australia, from all of Canada and the United States. And if you can't call in, we've got a web-based call. You can even do that. Or you can just chat. And there are trained agents. We have 200... We have hundreds of people volunteering for Recovering from Religion, and there are trained agents that can help you deal with almost anything. And if you're Muslim or ex-Muslim, having doubts about your religion, we have agents that can help you get in contact with people like Susanna and Armin and Ali. We can get you in touch with the right people. We look at ourselves as a clearinghouse to help you find the help you need. And we train all our agents to be very good listeners and very caring. They will never judge you. They will never try to convert you or deconvert you. That's not their job. So, and if you'd like to help somebody else, you think you might want to volunteer, hit the volunteer button. And you have to go through a process, because we don't let anybody into our organization that doesn't learn and get trained. And you'll learn a lot of skills. And Susanna's going to say, if you volunteer, I'm not saying you personally, Susanna, I know you got your hands full, but if somebody like Susanna wanted to volunteer, we would put you through a lot of training. And I guarantee you all the training we give you is equal to pretty much the first few classes you would ever take in a psychology degree program in how to help people. Cause we train people very well. So, yep. And
I want to go through your training one day.
Pardon?
I said, I want to go through your training.
All right. One day. Well, you can do it. You can do it without being a volunteer. We don't care. The other thing is we have a secular therapy project that is made up of 461 and counting therapists that are all vetted. They're evidence-based. They use science, and they can help you with almost anything you want. Get on seculartherapy.org, register, and look for a therapist near you. We have therapists in 6 different countries now: Australia, South Africa, the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, Canada, United States, Australia. So we're looking to expand. We're continually expanding. But even if you can't find somebody near you, a lot of therapists, because COVID, will now talk to you on the phone or on a video program like this. Mm-hmm. So that was the main thing I wanted to let people know about, Armin.
And guys, link's going to be, this is just a patron. Right now, the live stream is just a patron with our patrons. But if you're listening to this, the public version of this, the audio version of this, that means that all the links are in the description. So everything that Dr. Ray said, there's going to be a link to it. So check the description and you will find all of that there, all the information you need. And please go support us because they're doing a lot of great work. And we do need to encourage organizations that doing such great work that, you know, that they need to get noticed. Like, the fact that they're not already known by a lot of people is a crime, in my opinion. So, yeah, and also don't just go follow them, also share them as well, because they're putting a lot of effort and a lot of time at making these programs work, and it doesn't take much for you, like, if once you go there and see that they're creating such great content and providing so much great services, please don't just follow them, share them as well, so that you could encourage more work like this. So yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, we don't have time for our patron questions. If not, that's okay. But just one.
Do we have to keep this 1 hour?
No, I mean, that depends on Dr. Ray. And no pressure, Dr. Ray.
Oh, I'm happy to stay longer. I just didn't know what time you guys had to cut off. Oh, no, I'll stay in. I can stay another 25, 20 minutes, something like that.
Okay, just go. Ali, do you want to quickly just go through the Patreon questions? Because I don't.
Yeah, we can go through the Patreon questions for sure.
All right. Let me just bring.
I'm going to have to start from the beginning.
Hi, Luke.
Hi, everybody. Okay, so Luke is saying, is the shame around sex naturally occurring and co-opted by religions, or is it a byproduct of the ingrained religious culture? Because it seems to affect even non-religious communities.
That's a good question, but remember, no matter where you were born or raised, you are in a religious community. You could be raised by an atheist family in the United States, and you're surrounded by Christian craziness. So if you look at, there are cultures that are sex positive. I will point to the Muoso in China, and there's the shame and guilt simply don't seem to be there. So we have some evidence. If you study other cultures, that the key is, don't let yourself be fooled that Western culture or Islamic or Hindu culture are normal. Once you realize they are abnormal in terms of the greater history of culture, then you start looking at other cultures and you realize that there's lots of other ways of being sexual. And shame and guilt, I'm not saying they aren't present in other cultures, but there are cultures in Polynesia, for example, the Hawaiian Islands. Before Western contact, you could get your head cut off for eating the wrong food, but nobody cared who you had sex with. And there was the concept of marriage was only reserved for the royalty. The concept of marriage is not universal. There's no imperative in every culture for marriage. There just isn't. There's a Manganian culture in the South Pacific that seems to be very sex-free or guilt-free. No shame and guilt among the Manganians in the South Pacific. There a lot of Polynesian cultures were incredibly sex positive. Until the Presbyterians arrived, until the Muslims arrived, you know, until the Catholics arrived. So, no, the answer to the question is no, it's not natural. There may be a little bit. I don't know how you get something natural that's cultural. I mean, shame and guilt are a cultural concept. Bonobos don't have shame and guilt, and neither do chimpanzees. And we're just primates. So I'm guessing if we didn't have culture telling us to be shameful and guilty, we wouldn't feel guilt or shame.
Yeah, I feel like we could do a whole episode on shame and guilt with you and would love to talk about that because that completely fascinates me. Katie Rin is asking, what about the cultures which started showing a trend of becoming sexually repressive even before getting influenced by Abrahamic religions?
There were some cultures with incredibly sex negative practices. I'm not saying non-Western, non-Abrahamic cultures weren't. I'm just saying a lot of them were very sex positive. And as Western culture and Islamic culture took over the world, and Hindu culture, by the way, took over the world, they eradicated all these sex positive. Here's an example of it's just as obvious as the nose on your face if you visit India. If you look at some of the temples in India, they have orgies sculptured out on their religious temples. Now, if you ask a local what's going on there, oh, they'll make some bullshit statement up for you. But the fact was, a thousand years ago, Hindu culture was incredibly sex positive. One of the more sex positive cultures on the planet. What changed? I'll tell you what changed. Islam came in. When the Mughals took over India, they wiped out the sex-positive cultures. They went down to the south of India, where women routinely walked around topless and said, you better cover up or we're chopping your head off. They did not convert all the Hindus to Islam, but they did make the Hindus obey Islamic sexual practices. So as recently as 1,000 years ago, the evidence is on the walls of their temples. You can't deny the sex positivity of what you see right there before your eyes.
Kama Sutra.
That was the basis of all that. You're absolutely right. And it was written about 800 AD, I believe the Kama Sutra was. Mm-hmm. So how do you get such a widely popular and used and sculpted piece of literature if you don't have some level of sex positivity? Now, I'm not saying they weren't still misogynistic, because there were still elements of misogyny. That just came with the territory and is pretty common among a lot of cultures, whether it's sex positive or not. It's a spectrum. Think of it as a spectrum. Islam and Christianity are about as sex negative as you can get. And on the other end, the Manganians are about as sex positive as you can get. And then there's cultures everywhere in between. So, you know, where was Hinduism? Well, may have been 50% in the middle. That's still a hell of a lot more positive than Islam is.
Yeah. Lois is asking, even after deconverting, we often don't realize that our attitudes and emotions about sex are left over from religion. How does a psychologist help people understand that and get over it?
That is such a great question. And let me just say, you will find all the answers right here. I guarantee it.
And he's showing a picture for those who are listening, a picture of his book, Sex and God, which is a phenomenal book, by the way.
It wasn't a picture. It was the book itself.
Sex and God. I'm not just touting the book. I entirely agree. My biggest challenge as a psychologist is to help people get over the trauma, sexualized trauma that they bring into my oftentimes. Here's where I begin. I begin with everybody this way. That's not to say it works equally well with everybody, but I start with masturbation. And my words to you are, this is the only life you have. It's the only body you're going to get. And it's designed for pleasure. Pleasure yourself and learn how to pleasure yourself and pay attention to the guilt message while you're masturbating, while you're playing with your clit, or your dick. You just enjoy and pay attention to the guilt messages. You can do two things at once. You know, you can be ambidextrous, play with your clit in one hand and listen to the voices in the other, and realize those are shame programs, and just say, aha, I see you there. I hear you there. I'm going to keep having fun, and just practice that. The longer you do it, the less that voice, the quieter it'll get until you just can focus on enjoying your body. If you can do that alone will get you halfway to where you want to go sexually. I almost guarantee it.
So the solution is to masturbate more often.
The solution is to enjoy your body. I don't care if it's masturbating, enjoying a good meal, enjoying a good massage, a shower, a swim, a sunbathe. Enjoy your body. It's the only one you've got.
Right.
Masturbation isn't the only way to enjoy your body.
What about the people who actually enjoy a little bit of a guilt?
Well, go for it. I have a great story that the Catholics among our listeners will appreciate. I had a girlfriend back in like 1989, we were dating. We only dated for about 4 or 5 months. And I never went to her house. She always came to my house. And then one day I was in the neighborhood and I'd been there before, but I didn't go very often. And I knocked on her door. Remember, this before cell phones. And she let me in. I go in there and I notice in her bedroom, she's got crucifixes and Mary pictures and Bibles, all this religious stuff in her bedroom. And I'd never seen that before. So I asked her, hey, Gina, what's all this religious stuff doing in your bedroom? And here's her very words. Well, Daryl, if I know you're coming over, I take it down because I just can't come with Jesus watching me.
That was the first thing I thought.
Wow. I wonder if you hear the guilt messages and you start developing a Pavlovian association. Yeah. It's like, oh, I can't. I need someone to make me to get.
Yeah.
I have a confession, actually. Oh, this stuff is bringing up so many things for me. In Pakistan, where I grew up, right, you had the adhan, the prayer call that rings out over everything.
Right.
And if you ever want to do anything, you had a girlfriend, you want to make out or do anything like that, you had to do it outside because there's no – well, for us, there was no place to go unless you had a friend with an apartment or anything. So you'd always find these out. So, like, my sex life for the first, like, at least many years was just under trees in parks. It was all outdoors.
In the woods.
Yeah. And
it's old school cruising.
Yeah. And 5 times a day, you'd hear this prayer call. And I started developing a thing, like, because, you know, the prayer call would be happening and I'd be, you know, we'd be going at it. And it would happen at the same time. And for some reason, I developed this weird association between the adhan and, like, you know, I don't know.
It's not weird. It's not weird. It's simple conditioning. It's simply.
It's kind of hot making that.
Yeah. And remember, that's probably where fetishes come from. When people have kinks and fetishes, they probably come from that. I could talk about we could do a whole program just on
where to do a whole different prayer call.
There's a lot of, I can't even remember how many Iranian TV series and movies I've seen in Iran that a boy was just about to do something sexy and they were going down the wrong path and they were just about, yeah, they were like, and then the azan played and they came to their senses and they got reminded like, oh my God, God is watching. Like, it seemed like right before they were about to do something bad, you know, God saved them the azan started playing and they were like, oh my God. So again, that's a major theme actually in a lot of movies and TV series. So that's,
it is. It is.
Yeah.
Right. This question by Luke, I really want to answer that one. Can
I'm going to read it out. I was going to say, we never came to our senses during the azan. We just came. But anyway, Luke McDonald,
over it.
Personal experience. Luke McDonald is asking, is there a way to explain this quote unquote brokenness to partners and other people? A partner and I got so far, but then I ended up breaking down on them. It kind of killed it because they were so freaked.
Luke is an ex-Catholic, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Whoa, that's helpful too. Okay. Well, first of all, I want to throw that damn word out. I hate the word brokenness. You are not broken, period. Get rid of that concept. That concept is more destructive than helpful, in my estimation. What you have is a developmental delay. You, as we said earlier, you have skipped some developmental phases, or you haven't gotten through some developmental phases. Normal, natural things. You may be 10 years behind what most people would be because of your Catholicism. So I would explain it to the partner. I'm still dealing with the programming my Catholic background gave me. It probably disturbed my developmental my development, and let's take it slow and easy and enjoy ourselves. And I'm, with your help, I'm going to get over this shit, and I want to enjoy you and you want to enjoy me. So I would take that approach. It's not it's an approach that says it's normal. If you'd had a physical disability, you would tell that person, I have a physical disability. I can't do missionary position. I only can do some other position. And your partner would probably understand that. Or I need lots of warm up because I'm still trying to deal with my own demons around my Catholic. I like lots of kissing. I like lots of touching. I like some sexy talk. You know, whatever it is, tell them what you want, what you need, and experiment. Because that, I want to remind Luke, but I want to remind everybody, sex is first and foremost play. So what you're learning to do in sex, you're learning to play with another human being. You're learning to play at giving them pleasure and teaching them how to give you pleasure. If you approach it as learning to play, you're going to get a lot farther down the road than using the categories that the Catholic Church taught you, brokenness, that's religious bullshit. That, just to put it mildly. All right.
There's so much to say about this lexicon, like the brokenness, losing virginity, losing your innocence. I mean, you have a term like losing virginity for something when you're actually gaining a new aspect of your life,
exactly.
A new right. like natural thing. Right. It's a, and we've internalized.
Yeah, remember, it's virginity insane. Is a religious concept. It's not a biological. There's no such thing as virginity. It is a figment right. of religious imagination. So get rid yeah. of that bullshit.
Yeah, when you gain new experiences in life, people usually don't describe it as losing something.
Yeah,
you're not losing anything.
Yeah. No, but you don't do that with anything else. I mean, people do it as a joke now. They come like, oh, you know, but most of the time you say like, oh, this was my first time that I went to this, that I left my country. This is my first time eating this. This is my first time watching this type of a movie. But all of a sudden, when it comes to having sex, they're like, oh, I lost something. No, you didn't. You gained something. you gained a new experience. Before we go to the last question, I do want to remind people who are watching this not live and who are not a patron that if you want to participate in these live discussions with us and ask your questions like the other people in the live chat, that you can become a patron. Link to our Patreon is in the description. Once you do become a patron, we do send you messages about when we're about to go live and how you could participate. Ali, last question.
Okay, so we're going to go with the last question. I also want to tell everybody that we have our end of month Q&A happening on Friday night. It's Friday night. That is public. That's for everybody. There's no time limit. You can ask anything you want to, and there's going to be just a few days before the election. So yeah, just bring in your questions and let's go with it. Last question for Dr. Ray, who's been incredibly generous with his time. Katie's asking, okay, I have this question. There is this concept of Gungut, which came about 2,000 years ago, which is before Islam. So is it fair that Islam boosted the repressiveness which was already present? So
This is about Hinduism, by the way. This is in Hinduism. But well,
it's basically just it's a veil that covers a head and comes over the face. So it's part of Pakistan culture and Indian culture. I think it's a subcontinental word.
Yeah,
Gungut. So it's about veiling and keeping your women under some sort of
right.
Yeah.
Well, keep in mind that when Muhammad was conquering the Arabian Peninsula, he was conquering a whole lot of other cultures, some of which practiced this very practice, only it was in Saudi Arabia. So when he conquered it, he did not necessarily say you have to do it X, Y, or this way or that way. He oftentimes let the cultures continue in the female repressive practices they already had. He didn't interfere with them. In fact, female genital mutilation predates Islam, and he let them continue doing that as well. Male circumcision was a Jewish practice. Nobody else practiced it around there, but he let the Jews who converted to Islam keep circumcising their boys. So that was the brilliance of Muhammad. Muhammad, as I say in my book, The God Virus, Muhammad created the most successful religion on the planet. I don't mean by numbers. I mean by speed and power. He did it. He was a genius militarily, but more importantly, he was a religious genius. He knew how to capture people. And rather than force people to adopt certain practices, he let them stay. Well, he did the same thing when he went to India, when his followers went to India, they simply continued letting. Well, some of these practices are beneficial in some way, shape, or form, obviously to the males controlling the women. So they flourish and the practices expand. And that's the Mughals. The Mughals really enforced this all over India and all sorts of places that it didn't exist before. So I don't know this particular name. I've never heard that name before. But the fact is the practice of covering women is not new to Islam by a long shot.
Yeah, Gungut is usually on the night of the wedding night. Uh-huh. The bride sort of sits in a very shy or coy way with her this sort of veil hanging over her head, so you can't see her face. I mean, that's the whole idea. So it's similar to any other kind of veiling, part of modesty culture, quote unquote modesty. Luke is saying of the final comment here, he's saying, and I think we agree with him, guys, this live stream has been brilliant, genuinely really helpful. Tell Ray thanks so much. We'll definitely check out his book. I would second that. You should definitely check out the book. And
And follow again. Another reminder, Recovering from Religion, check them out, search for them. Again, if you're listening to the public version of this, all the links are in the description. Go do, there's a lot more resources. You've had this live stream is good. Imagine all the resources that is available, that was built throughout the many years of by many volunteers under the supervision of Dr. Ray. So yeah, if you need help, go check them out. And also recommend Dr. Daryl Ray and his book and his organization to people that you know need help as well. Like if you know somebody else that could benefit from this, let them know about this. Okay, all right. So you want to say goodbyes, Ellie? You were saying something that I interrupted. You were saying thank you. That's what.
Who, me? I was. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I just want to say thank you. This was amazing. I wish I had met you. I don't know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 45 years ago, and I am 45. I just wish I'd always known you and I'd always had you around. So many things, my entire life would have been so different. I mean, no regrets, but still. And it would have been just amazing to have you around. Thank you very much, and I don't think I'm the only one who feels that way. So thank you.
I've heard that a few times in my life. But I always love hearing it. I love it. I want to say one thing to Susanna. You have you may not know it, but your name evokes the memory of Susanna and the Elders, a Bible story.
Yes.
Okay.
It's biblical.
Have you seen the opera, Susanna and the Elders?
No, I haven't seen the opera. I do know the story though in the Book of Daniel.
Well, go get the opera. I think it's maybe available on YouTube or something, but you'll find it very interesting and it illustrates everything we just talked about here tonight.
Oh, beautiful.
Wow. I'm going to look for it, too.
I'm an opera nut. I love opera.
I love it. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Ray. It was really nice.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.